All right, thanks very much first for the invitation to come here. Right, so I'm giving the first talk here, and so I suppose I should be somewhat more broad, which I'm not, so I still end up talking about my own works with a number of fine collaborators here listed. But still, I tried to phrase them in broad terms, the various topics. So I will talk about signatures of dark matter below or well below the GeV scale. And I have to offer three signatures for you. So the first signature will be absorption, the second signature scattering, and the third signature decay. And so regarding, I included absorption yesterday because the buzzword was mentioned a number of times in this in the discussion. And so here I want to show you some work where we use dark photons as dark matter, and you can think of this as sort of a prototype model for dark matter absorption on atoms in direct detection experiments. So much of this work will, much of this talk will actually be focused on direct detection, which is part of the sensitivity frontier, I guess. So in the second part, I will then talk about the scattering of dark matter, namely the scattering of sub-GeV mass dark matter on nuclei and sub-MeV dark matter on electrons. And then the third part, the decay part, will be on exploring decaying dark matter scenarios into new hidden states, so not into the observable sector. And we again will look at the sensitivity from direct detection. And in the end, I would also like to mention a little bit 21 centimeter cosmology. I figured this is a timely topic and probably want to talk about it earlier than later, because there might be an expiry date on this anomaly you're probably all aware of. All right, so here is a well-known plot to every one of you. This is basically a partial summary of more than two decades of experimental effort looking for dark matter in the laboratory through direct scattering, so dark matter mass versus dark matter nuclear cross-section here, and all these lines are null results, are excluding this range of parameters up here, and at some point we will hit an irreducible background coming from neutrinos, the so-called neutrino floor. And so if you want to make progress in this particular plot, what you have to do is either build bigger experiments and add more exposure to become sensitive to ever smaller cross-sections, or if you want to go to the left of this plot, you need to find lower the threshold of your detector. Or a third possibility is actually trying to use existing data and find alternative ways of find other physics which is sort of not of which is not living in this restricted plane here, and increase the physics output of the existing experiments. And so my talk will be focused on these two possibilities here. Okay, so when we talk about light new physics, very often this is done in terms of the portal language, and so there are three distinguished ways of coupling new physics to gauge invariant operators of the standard model on the renormalizable level. So this is, can be the Higgs portal here, a neutrino portal, which might be actually realized in nature because we know neutrinos have mass, or the vector portal, which is a special case of a vector times current portal, if you want. And so, yes, please.
Do you mind going back? So, what is L?
It's just a lepton doublet, standard model Higgs, and N is a right hand neutrino. Yeah, so H is standard model Higgs here. And so, what regards the first point of my talk, absorption signatures, we pick the third portal because we want to have bosonic dark matter. And so this vector portal is very simple, and I guess you're all familiar with it. We extend the standard model gauge group with another U1, and we can have a kinetic mixing of this new vector boson to standard model hypercharge, which at low energies becomes a mixing between just the photon and this new boson. This new vector must be massive, otherwise you can just rotate away the mixing, unless this vector is also coupled to a new or dark field, then you can use this dark photon actually as a mediator to of a new force. So here will be considered with dark photon dark matter, but you can also use dark photons to mediate the interactions of another dark matter particle to the standard model. Okay, so in terms of motivation, which was asked yesterday by Nathaniel, this probably fits his metric of being very well motivated, in the sense that such kinetic mixing can easily be generated through loops of particles that are charged under both U1s here, a U1 hypercharge and this new U1 prime, and it doesn't matter really how heavy these particles are, because there's sort of a non-decoupling of this radiatively induced mixing. And so you can think of this kinetic mixing as a low energy messenger from the high energy scale. All right,
please. Can you go back two slides? Yeah, that one. If you add that extra symmetry on there, do other things need to come also with that dark photon, or is that it?
That can be it. So you can give a mass to this dark photon through what's called a Stackelberg mechanism. So it's like a hard dark photon mass, or you can Higgs it. Then you would have an additional field in there and additional interactions, but you don't need that. So this kinetic mixing, there are two equivalent ways of thinking about it. I mean, you can just leave this mixing in there as a perturbation, and then you get a Feynman diagram of this sort, where this photon dark photon mixing is manifest, and then such a picture suggests experimental avenues like light shining through wall experiments, where you have photon dark photon oscillation. Alternatively, you may diagonalize this kinetic term here, you rotate it away, and then ordinary matter gets a millicharge under this new force with a strength kappa, kinetic mixing times electric charge, and such a picture suggests an experimental signatures like the scattering of the emission of real vectors and the scattering of electrons or protons on fixed targets, etc. And this is of course, heavily pursued in what's called the intensity frontier, and you have seen pictures of this sort, dark photon mass versus kinetic mixing, and all sorts of...
Can you clarify intensity frontier, because there is the same language is used for something very different, as I suspect, in atomic physics.
Uh-huh.
So what specifically...
I just mean a low energy, high intensity beams, basically, that are able to produce light near physics.
That's it.
So you can think of Bell, Babar, or protons and electrons and fixed targets, that I would say, or ships and so on.
Right, but what if you're talking about the very different intensity frontier of ultrasound lasers?
Okay.
Any
I think
I've been asked by
I don't know, you know, so I'm not based in the US. I think that this whole language of the various frontiers, this came out it came out of the various community brought here, so
but nevertheless, this is a very large community which is relatively unconnected to the entire effort of BSM physics.
Okay.
Which could be. Okay. If somebody will sort out what exactly can actually be measured.
Right. I think we can
so what
we can talk about the physics later, and this is just terminology or semantics, I don't know.
So basically, yes. You should think about multi-dark photon processes, okay?
I will talk about resonances, so maybe this goes in the direction.
Okay.
Anyway, the only thing I want to say here is that this picture is part of a much bigger dark photon landscape. So this picture gets shrunk up into this little corner here, where we have on the log-log plane, basically this shows our ignorance to where new physics can be. And importantly...
Can you actually go back to
Yes, please.
so the status.
Which one? This one.
So the status is.
This is not the most actual picture, actually. Sorry. Right,
just to clarify that dark quantums cannot explain G minus two.
That's right.
Completely ruled out at this point.
Yes. So this the simplest version is.
A dark quantum that couples to all, to electrons.
Right.
Right.
Yes. Right. So. So here, what brings me now to my first point is actually to consider this dark photon landscape below the dielectron threshold, so then dark photons can't decay into a plus or minus. That makes them cosmologically long-lived. They can still decay into three photons, but that's a rate which decouples very quickly, and so here you have a dark matter candidate. So,
sorry,
yes?
There's always a funny shape to this whole dark matter region, which, at lower masses.
This one here.
Yeah, the structure.
Yeah. Actually, so it's maximally confusing shaded. So the red region is the viable dark matter region.
Viable region, right.
Yes.
Structures in the viable dark matter region are set by.
This is. I forgot. This is, I think, so here what is assumed is that you have an initial condensate of dark photons, and then the stuff evaporates. And so you need to make sure that enough survives. And
It's not that.
It's not that?
No, this is conversion of dark photons into CMB photons.
So no,
that's the
boundary. No, sorry. Yeah, yes, you're right. So this boundary is the leakage of CMB photons into dark photons.
Yeah.
This one here.
Leakage of dark photons into CMB photons.
Good. Right, and so you lose dark matter.
Oh, no, but that signature you see isn't the loss of dark matter. The signature you see is distortions of the CMB.
Okay, sorry.
Can we just clarify what's being plotted there?
Yeah.
The region under the cold dark matter, is that defined as a viable cold dark matter as dark photons?
Yes.
Okay.
This one here.
So in this case, this is where the dark photons would be the viable cold dark matter.
Yeah. That's right.
So is that dip sort of at around the temperature of the CMB? Is that the point? Or how does that work?
So this is to do with, so you get maximum conversion when you go through the resonant frequency, so the plasma frequency of the medium.
Right.
In the universe is the same as the mass. So this is through the ionization history of the universe.
So
the efficiency conversion depends on how fast you go through a particular mass, plasma frequency.
Right.
Okay.
And so it depends on how fast the universe is evolving in terms of ionization history. So it's complicated, kind of complicated.
Okay.
It's a level crossing.
It's what?
It's like a level crossing. So you go from a region.
I'll actually get to this point. I mean, there. I guess this sharp feature is probably a recommendation. What you see here, just jump
in
the plasma mass.
Also, to some extent, a bit of an approximation. I think it's to some extent a bit of an approximation in the kind of bounds that would derive. I'm not sure whether it would actually look like.
Yeah.
What
you're doing. I'm not going to be concerned about this region in terms of dark photon dark matter, but I will actually have to offer dark photon photon conversion later on, which happens at a later redshift. But anyway. Right, so.
In solar lifetime, are there other astrophysical bounds for cooling of.
Which lifetime?
Objects? It says
solar lifetime. Yes, so this is a solar lifetime, horizontal branch stars, then there's also red, there should be red giants here.
I
so.
And where's the supernova?
Where is it? Here.
And
it's white. You can't see it, it's shaded lightly.
Below the dark gray.
Below
the dark gray there, just above an MeV. From an MeV to 100 MeV, below the dark gray.
Okay.
All right, so what I actually want to talk about is this region here, so where we're not sensitive to these oscillations. And I think So the message here is that this absorption, the way I'm phrasing it, it's very general. And so it can, in principle, there's a lesson to be learned here. And so let's look at the amplitude for, say, we have dark photon, dark matter, and it gets absorbed on a system. Okay, so it interacts with the electromagnetic current. Now, let's write the amplitude for this process. And here we have the Lagrangian, and we can use the equation of motions. for an on-shell vector to rewrite in this form. So we have a kappa mv squared, and here we have manifestly the mixing between the photon and the vector. And so if you have this absorption here, we get kappa times mv squared from here. So this is the mixing insertion. Then we get a photon propagate, and the photon propagator would be 1 over p squared minus the self-energy of the photon in that material. And there's a self-energy for transverse and longitudinal modes. P squared is just mv squared because the dark photon is on shell here. And this is just the matrix element of the electromagnetic current and times the polarization vector. And so if we square this, we get to the decay rate, where we have now this kappa squared, which is sort of the effective mixing angle of the dark photon inside a medium. And this commutator here of the electromagnetic current, that's related to the polarization tensor of the photon in the medium.
Sorry, so you start off from neutral, the initial state is neutral.
You can plug in whatever you want as initial and final state. But yes, I mean, we apply it to direct detection experiments where these are individual atoms, basically, initial and final state. But let me just comment this on in a second. So what you can then do is you relate this commutator to the imaginary part of this polarization functions. And that basically is the optical theorem. And so this is a very nice result because it's very general. And basically, after we have applied this technique to the existing liquid xenon experiments, there has been a lot of activity of identifying new materials you can use for absorbing new physics of this type. And the name of the game is basically to evaluate this function here. So this is sort of a target-independent formulation here, and then all you have to do is to find what are your polarization functions in your new medium, may it be a semiconductor or a superconductor or whatever. Okay, and so we do this for xenon, and there you can actually relate these polarization functions to the refractive index of the medium, and then just use data. Or you can also go, there are two distinguished physicists who actually can do these calculations, but we can just go into the atomic data tables and for getting the overall ionization rate. Why liquid xenon? Well, the reason is because they're very sensitive to small energy deposits. So if you say have a 100 eV dark photon that gets absorbed, then all this mass is available for lifting the electron outside of the shell, ionize it, and then create additional electrons that can be picked up. And so such a scattering or such an absorption classifies as an electron recoil.
Yes? Can you clarify again how that would differ from the normal WIMP signal when you have initial gamma rays and...
Yeah, let me come to this now. Well, so here's the point. So up to this point, this is sort of a target independent statement, if you want. And now you have to apply to your detector of choice. And for liquid xenon type detectors, this signal would look like an electron recoil. Now let me say how the signal evolves in these experiments. So you absorb your dark photon, and then you produce a number of ions and a number of excitons, basically. I mean, so you absorb the photon, the electron gets kicked out, it produces excitations and ionizations of neighboring xenon atoms. Then there's some recombination, so you shuffle around the number of free electrons versus the number of excited atoms, which eventually relax via scintillation. And then a fair fraction of these ionized electrons survive the drift, so there's an electric field applied. then there's a liquid gas surface where these drifted electrons also produce scintillation, and in the end of the day, what you collect is scintillation light through photomultipliers, and these are the famous S1 and S2 signals. And so, importantly for these experiments, if you want to detect scintillation directly, then the efficiency for doing so is relatively low, so you need order of 10 scintillation photons produced to detect an average one. But all you need is one ionized electron that survived the drift, and it can give you already an S2 signal. So this is why low threshold searches often employ S2 only and discard the S1 signal. Of course, at every point, the signal fluctuates here, given by binomial distributions or Poisson distributions. And then, so if you put in a certain electromagnetic energy, then you get a region in S1, S2 space, which is given to you by the PDF. The difference to nuclear recoils, and that goes back to your question, is that at the interaction point, you lose a fair amount into heat. And so there's this, the recoil is quenched, if you want, and so that's basically microscopically the only difference, I would say.
In the previous slide,
this is electron recoil or photons injected.
How will that then affect the detectable signal?
Sorry?
Because you're not directly tracking the heat loss.
No, yeah, so you can't see the heat loss. That's right. So your scintillation signal becomes quenched.
Okay.
This is very important aspect of understanding how much light and charge you actually get out from very soft recoils.
Is NR on that scatter plot nuclear recoil?
Here? No, there's no NR here. Ah, plus NR. So actually, I don't know how experimentally this plot is made. So this NR here?
No, the one in the corner.
Sorry?
Bottom up.
Ah, this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess this is how a nuclear recoil would look like. But I don't know the details of this plot. Particulars from Panda X. Yeah. All right. But if you go through this machinery of modeling your signal in various in this liquid signal detectors, then you're able to derive limits and here on the dark photon absorption, and you can do similar things with axions and so on.
This is if it makes up all the dark matter.
Here it makes up all the dark matter. That's correct. And it sort of it sits in a region where there's no issue of evaporation.
So what would be the main standard
or oscillation
signals?
Sorry?
What would be the main standard model signals which will produce electron recoils as well?
There's a lot of radioactive background, so you get Compton scattering, for example. That's a big issue. If you talk really about very low energetic events, then it becomes very complicated. So very few ionized electrons, for example, is very hard to understand in terms of what are really the backgrounds. You know, there are things like oxygen impurities inside the Xena detector, which attach an electron, and then you produce scintillation light, and the electron gets detached and produces a single electron, so on. So it's very complicated business to really understand. But first order approximation, these radioactive backgrounds.
So it would be actually possible to distinguish the dark photon signal from the standard model signal. So what I'm trying to understand, if you...
Here it's very easy to distinguish because this is dark photon, dark matter, and so you convert all of the mass into energy, and so it's basically lying in the detector at a certain energy. Because the kinetic energy is suppressed with V squared, so 10 to the minus 6, so it's very, very small effect. So it sticks out if it's not a... Yeah.
So in this... On this blue line, in the low mass range, then it doesn't have enough energy to trigger the signal.
Yeah, that's right. So here, this is 10 eV. So I should have said thanks. This is the binding energy of the most outer bound electron is 12 eV, and so once the mass is below that, energetically you can't do it.
I don't understand the bounds
But how about those wiggles?
This here, yeah, this is a diffuse gamma ray bound. So here you are in the KV regime, and that photon can decay into three photons. And so, but
it's just a line. I'm trying to understand.
No, so everything here is excluded. Sorry. Yeah. So this is a, this goes. This has 1, 2, 3, 4 propagate electron propagators. So this is has a very high power in electron mass over dark photon mass. Dark photon mass over electron mass is a very steep boundary, if you want.
How about those wiggles?
Hmm?
High mass region, it's like go to let's say 100 eV. You see those bumps?
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is basically. I mean, this is the imaginary part of the. Of the polarization function, which corresponds to the absorption probability. So whenever a new shell opens up, you will see the spikes, and the real imaginary part are related through dispersion relations.
So it's agnostic to the production mechanism.
Hmm?
Like you're not fixing the abundant parameter space as the production ratio.
No. So the where the photon abundance comes from is a different story here. So this is you can produce it through during inflation or this. I mean, you can have an initial condensate, but then there are also papers written on the longitudinal production of these molecules.
Well, the limits improve with much larger detectors.
I don't think so because, yeah, so these are a few electron rates, and going to a bigger detector is not helping you with this.
How does this compare to the S1 only analysis and stuff that some people do?
S1 only? S2 only.
Sorry, S2 only for the... for.
This is S2 only.
This is S2.
Oh, this is S2 only. Actually, I don't know. So it's a few years back. I don't remember... No, this is S1 plus S2, I think, because it's high enough in energy, 1 kV. But this one certainly is S1 only.
So why is it...
I actually forgot. I made this plot, but I forgot. But please.
Yeah, so why is it a legitimate thing to look at the signatures without worrying about what the production mechanism is?
No, you can. So you have to worry if enough dark matter... So you can't make thermal dark matter.
Right.
The coupling is super tiny, so the Friesen production is not enough. So you need something else. And so in that sense, it's not that natural. So you need to postulate a pre-existing abundance of these dark photons. They will survive, but where they come from is a different story. I mean, there are various mechanisms you can produce them. So there are candidate mechanisms to give you the abundance. But it can, for example, be very sensitive to age of age during inflation, so Hubble scale during inflation, and so there's no good motivation why it should be the dark matter abundance.
I guess
in all fairness,
it's more like, you know, whatever mechanism you're using to produce that abundance.
Yeah.
You know, there will be some other particle that coupled to this photon, right? And in principle.
You don't have to. So during inflation, gravity does it for you.
Okay.
So all you need is this particle, and it comes into existence through gravity. And it couples to electromagnetic charge, so, but not efficiently enough here. But so I'm moving very slowly here. The moral of this story is that dark photon absorption is only one case, if you want, in the simplified model space of bosonic dark matter. So you can consider other operators with particles that can be absorbed. And so in this plot, we have seen that the sensitivity of direct detection is really to very minute couplings. And so if you're not considering dark photons or, say, axions, which are protected, which in their mass are not protected by some symmetry, then generically you expect loop corrections to induce mass shifts. And so you might worry about the lightness of these particles. But what I've shown you is that these direct detection experiments, they probe very small couplings, and so if you expect the mass shift to be a coupling constant times some cutoff scale, then this here is still a small number with the values you're able to probe. So that's a moral here, so that you can extend this kind of study, consider other candidates.
Okay.
All right. Now let me move on to a second part, the scattering on nuclei. And the question I'd like to ask here is, how can we make progress in this direct detection plot today, and extend our reach in the sub GeV, into the sub GeV region? Now, the reason why all these curves here turn up is, of course, kinematical, because the maximum recoil energy you can give to a nucleus when it scatters on dark matter is just 2 times the relative momentum, basically, the relative momentum transfer squared over the mass. And so, say you have a detector which is capable of picking up a 500 eV nuclear recoil, and say your dark matter weighs 1 GeV, then you can already see, in order to make this signal, you need a relative velocity to scatter on xenon of 1700 kilometers per second. And this is larger than any particle that is gravitationally bound to the galaxy would have. And so for a dark matter mass smaller than 1 GeV, it's impossible to produce to induce a 0.5 keV nuclear recoil on a xenon atom. And so there's sort of a kinematical no-go theorem why you can't go lower in mass here. And of course, as you know, many experimental alternatives have been proposed, like dark matter electron scattering, intensity frontier searches where you produce it on shell, these particles, or there are many ideas for new detection methods. Here, the proposal I want to put forward is you don't have to look at the elastic channel of dark matter nuclear scattering, but just consider the inelastic channel. So consider the case where the nucleus bremses off a photon. Then there are two key observations in this simple process. The first observation is that parametrically for light dark matter, the maximum energy the photon can have is much larger than the maximum recoil energy of the nucleus. So basically, the photon can get the entire kinetic energy. And the key observation two here is an experimental one, namely that if you say a 0.5 keV nuclear recoil, that's really hard to detect, but a 0.5 keV photon, that's never missed in these experiments. Of course, it will be buried in a background, in a larger background, but in principle, the signal is there. So, naively, you can compute this process very easily. The matrix element for the emission factorizes into two parts, the matrix element for the elastic scattering times a gauge invariant factor which describes the photon emission. And so if you compute the cross-section, you also get this factorization here in an elastic part times this factor here which describes the photon emission. There's, of course, a price to pay if you attach a photon, a factor of alpha, but that gets overcompensated by the charge of the electric charge of the nucleus. And so this is coherent emission of the photon, c squared, and so this overcompensates it for large atoms like xenon. But there's a second price to pay here, and that's basically you have to accelerate the nucleus in order to bremse off a photon, and that's a large factor, so that's on the order of 10 to minus 7.
This is the cross-section for...
This is a double differential cross-section here for dark matter scatters on the nucleus, and then it emits a photon. The nucleus emits a photon.
Sure. Yeah, I'm just wondering, so for the z squared... I'm not comparing that to 1, I'm comparing that to a squared that I normally get for...
So a squared is in here.
There's also a z squared.
There's an a squared in there. And there's an a squared in here, and there's a c squared in addition.
Why is there a z squared in addition?
So that's let me move on. So this is a very naive picture where the photon comes off a bare nucleus, and you should worry about this. Yes, but first of all, we should worry about the huge suppression factor here in this process. And the question is, can we overcome this? And the answer is yes, because these functions here are basically exponentially rising functions towards lower ER, and so we can tap an exponential there. and overcome this expression. So this is shown here in this picture, where you see dark matter of 1 GeV elastically scattering. So it cuts off at a nuclear recoil energy of 0.1 kV. So basically, that's just the velocity cutoff in the galaxy. But then there's much suppressed a photon spectrum which sort of seeps out of the elastic rate, and that's something you can experimentally tap, even though it's small. Now, coming back to your question, you should worry about this naive treatment of photon emission from a bare nucleus, and so you can alternatively go into the atomic physics picture of that. So how would that look like? So there you, dark matter kicks a nucleus, and momentarily displaces the nucleus from the electron cloud. So you produce a dipole, and on this dipole you emit the photon. So you produce a polarized atom for a short amount of time. And so we did this quantum mechanical calculation of dark matter scattering on the atom, polarizing it, and then emitting a photon. And the essential ingredient is there's a boost of the electron wave function relative to the nucleus. And then you go into the dipole approximation and you can evaluate this.
What's the recoil energy of the nucleus?
Yeah, so it's, well, at the photon endpoint, it's zero. And then, I mean, it's free body kinematics.
Where this calculation is applicable?
Sorry, where?
Where this calculation is applicable, how big is it?
Yeah, so it will break down at the very endpoint of the photon energy, but it's applicable everywhere else. I'm not sure what you have in mind. What's your worry, or?
Does the xenon atom actually die? Does the nucleus come out?
Ah.
Because the way you're describing
So yeah, okay, good. So here you have an atom in the initial state and you have an atom in the final state, and quantum mechanically anything in between. And you can evaluate this expression in generality, or you can take a simplification where you take the initial state equals the final state of the atom. So actually you end up with a neutral atom in the end. Dark matter scatters on the nucleus.
The atom's never ionized.
No, the atom is never ionized. That's right. So this is one contribution. There will be more contributions with the atom being in excited states or in ionized state. And so all this will add up to the total rate. And then you can put a less conservative bound.
That's why I'm asking what the recoil.
Okay. Understand
because
that.
It seems like you do have enough energy to ionize xenon, though.
Yeah, so that, yeah.
That's why
you're asking all great questions. I'll come to these points.
The TV, so you could definitely
analyze. Yes. Very good. There's also this contribution, a photon-less contribution, if you want. Right. So we have done this first because it's simpler. And it turns out if you take initial and final state equal, then you can relate this whole expression, the sum before, to what's called the polarizability of the atom. And again, this is something tabulated, and we can just go into the atomic data tables, take it out there, and compute the rate. And what you see is now this solid line here versus the dotted line. So the solid line is now using this data tables. And what's nice about this rate is that unlike the Bremsstrahlung, which goes like 1 over omega and becomes larger and larger for smaller energies, this atomic calculation gives you an omega cubed, and so it cuts off at lower and lower photon energies, and this is just the energy scaling of dipole emission. So that's very comforting, and in the high energy limit, when the photon becomes very hard and it doesn't care about the electron cloud anymore, then this function here goes like 1 over omega to the fourth power, and so you recover the naive calculation of Bremsstrahlung. So everything smoothly goes into each other. And that's what you see here. So that gives us confidence that what we're doing is right here.
Is there a sharp cutoff
No. Yeah, the cutoff comes from data that we don't know how this polarizability looks at small energies. Also, you don't see the omega cubed cutoff because the polarizability of atom is just of xenon is large.
Mm-hmm. You're saying that's something people actually calculated? Because the dynamic
polarizability
is a resonance. So
yeah, so there's no resonances in here.
Okay.
Yet.
So
yet.
Just some approximation.
Right.
Which is assumes there is no reservoir transitions, which probably be something from inner shells.
It's something we have been discussing, and we will discuss more during this workshop, yeah, with Andrei, actually, yeah.
It's in completely different regimes than normally calculated for the physics.
Okay.
Because usually you calculate it in
the yeah.
Well, visible way. Yeah.
We were so glad that we could find this polarizability that we didn't have to do anymore.
It's doable in the random phase approximation, for example.
Right. Well, so in RPA, you can run the number situation and see what comes out. So.
Can you go back to that plot? What's the solid blue line and the light dashed blue line?
So the solid blue line is
is
basically the data-driven rate of photon emission. Data-driven in terms of this polarizability is tabulated, and
so
we can use
it. The solid blue line is data.
Yeah, and the dotted line is the naive calculation of Bremsstrahlung of a bare nucleus.
So why is there a cutoff for the solid line?
No, there's no cutoff. So this is the polarizability. So the polarizability is again related to the refractive index, which is also related to these atomic scattering factors F1 and F2, and they are tabulated down to some energies. And at some point, you have to use Kramers-Kronig dispersion relations to relate the two, and so there was a little work involved, but we were not interested in lower photon energies. But
okay, can I just
yes, please.
Just to understand the detection. So I understand PMTs from like 1 to several EV.
Okay.
Do they work at 500 EV?
At 500 EV?
Yeah.
So the 500 EV photon doesn't make it. Yeah, sure. I mean, once a photon is produced, it will ionize other electrons, and then the whole process starts. And yeah, this is very well detected in this experiment. Sorry?
So a massive signal is generated?
Yes, I would say so. There's the interesting aspect of if the photon comes out very low energetically, below 12 eV, then you don't ionize another electron, and then xenon becomes transparent, and so you can use this method to turn your detector into a directional detector. That's something exciting we are working on. All right, and so this is now again, you take your photon signal, you crank it through the machinery of simulating the signal, and then we got these first limits on the first limits on sub 500 MeV dark matter nuclear scattering, basically. So this was pretty nice. I should say that, and this was asked before, what about the process where you just ionize an atom? Indeed, this process exists, and so it's lower order in alpha. And it's something which was on our menu to calculate, but then there was a Japanese group which calculated this this electron shake-off very nicely, I should say. That goes also under the name of Migdal effect. So Migdal was famous for doing very quick calculations, so you can derive the probability for such an ionization event to happen within one line, basically. You take the initial state wave function, and again you boost it, and then you project it onto the original wave function, and then you get the overall rate. But if you want to know it energy differentially, then you have to do a much more sophisticated job, and that's what this group has done, and they have calculated the probability of ionization as a function of electron recoil.
Just what
yes.
N?
Sorry?
What's N?
Yes.
Ah,
that's the most inner shell. That's the
ionization number?
Yeah. That's the bound electron that gets ionized.
One is the most bound, two is the second most bound.
Right.
Why is it harder to ionize the outer ones?
Why is it harder to? Actually, I don't know.
Yeah, this should be much easier to. Well, okay. It's probably because of the resonant processes. Because if you at EV scale, you're actually getting the inner electron out and not the outer electron out. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But as I go to lower energy, I would expect to get
right,
the...
Right, because when I say outer electron, we are talking about EV.
So, yeah, this goes down to an EV.
Right.
Seems like the outer one should be easy there.
Yeah. That's what I was saying. When it goes to EV, then you... Well, I mean, it's sub-EV. That's pretty useful. It's still sub-EV, but the inner shell will be okay. So, but it's still some other matter.
How many shells is CMOS?
Five PEC
most
time.
Right, so we're still talking about the multiple EV scales. So what's the deep for the green line?
Sorry?
Is the deep for the green line?
I don't know. This is just an the important point here is that if you consider this process, likewise you sort of seep out into the high energy part. So energetically, it's also favored, and so this is something you can tap.
KV scale. So does that part go into EV? Okay.
Yeah, so it will go into the atomic, inside the atomic regions.
And this is just so I understand. This is for what mass of the dark matter?
I'm very confused now because I thought I picked the lowest plot, which is 500 MeV, but now I don't understand the n equals 1 because it's n equals 1 is 30 kV binding energy on xenon, so I'm surprised now that so I have to go back into the paper. I'm surprised now that n1 is sort of.
So
can make it.
What is not clear, why do we have Na, which is sodium, there?
Yes, yeah, it's a sodium.
Thank you. So I picked the wrong plot. I should have taken xenon.
No.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, so now it makes sense.
Of course, does not have five shells, which would...
Yes, also true. Also, doesn't have... Sorry, I showed...
That
okay, I apologize. Yeah. I thought I picked xenon, but...
Well, it's probably easier to calculate for sodium.
How about this one?
It's
argon.
This is argon.
Okay, yeah, I did this very quickly, sorry. And very late night, but...
So xenon would have... Okay.
Okay, so the I
don't want to go into the details here, I just wanted to mention for completeness that there is this photon-less process, and it's actually stronger. And so, after our paper, they went and calculated this, and these gentlemen here then threw it through their detector simulation. So these curves, which you saw there, they threw it through their detector simulation and could get even stronger bounds on sub 500 MeV dark matter.
So you're saying that Bremsstrahlung is still the dominant channel?
No, Bremsstrahlung is smaller. So you get stronger limits if you take that, up to potential resonances and these things.
How do we know those wave functions for the electrons, let's say in xenon?
These are, these are Hartree-Fock wave functions they in the end employ. So I think Masahiro Iwa, he's a high energy theorist, but it went together with some atomic physicists and I guess they calculated for them.
Usual heavy dark matter nuclear recoil, the assumption is that it just fully ionizes. Nucleus just comes out and just ignores the electrons.
Yeah.
At what mass does that start to break down and you have to take account of these effects?
I think actually it happens, if the recoil is comparable to the binding energy of the electrons, I don't expect that you fully ionize the nucleus anymore. So there's also here in our Bremsstrahlung calculation, there's sort of a limit where if the scattering is not instantaneous, but sort of soft, you adiabatically move the whole atom and you don't do anything to it. So, you know, rather than polarizing it and emitting a photon, or rather than shaking off an electron, at some point you would just, for very soft recoils, it would just move the whole atom adiabatically.
My guess is
that if the recoil energy becomes comparable to the binding energy of the respective atom, for xenon, most inner bound is 30 kV and most outer bound is 12 eV.
30 kV.
Yes, so that's...
So when you want to look in the resonant section, because if you're matching exactly the energy for the ionization, boost the signal.
Yeah, I know. Very good.
Just to go back to the plot you had a few slides back. Yeah, this one. Are there models with cross sections that big at those masses, which sort of make sense at higher energies?
Right, yeah, so there's, do I have this? Right, so the one model we entertained is a gauged baryon number. So because, in a sense, what you want is, if you want to learn something new, you should suppress the cross-section to electrons. Because otherwise it's just easier to scatter on electrons and you constrain dark matter this way.
Yep.
And so a leptophobic model would be gauged baryon number.
So what mass do you imagine if you imagine, so you have imagining a mediator.
That's right. And so
what kind of mass of mediator are you imagining?
So we have one example here. This was a 300 MeV. I know there are a lot of constraints coming in from this here is a monojet constraint, but then there are also limits on, I mean, there was a paper of Maxime with Jeff Dwar on non-conserved. Okay, sorry. Here he goes on it. Okay, right. Then you know this. So there's a limit on what's the gauge.
So
okay.
Can you have
no? So yeah. So this will come in, but here it's fine.
Okay.
There's a limit. This limit here, actually, here dark matter starts scattering before reaching the detector, and the limits actually go away. So we are interested in lower cross section.
Okay, sorry, I didn't see the dots. The dotted line.
Yeah, I took out a lot of details here because I just wanted to move through these things more quickly. But so at some point you get into a diffusion limit of.
Yeah.
These limits don't go away instantaneously because if the mass of dark matter is very small compared to the target, then you lose little energy in each collision. But still, after a few collisions, you lost enough energy to not to have a signal anymore. All right. Okay. Now I have 5 minutes left.
We're putting our questions into your talk.
Okay. So I can just stop whenever you tell me to stop. Okay. Good. All right. So now let me stay with the scattering part, but now consider the scattering on electrons. And here we can pose exactly the same question. We have limits from dark matter electron scattering down to some mass range, but then ask the question, how can we go lower? And again, for galactic dark matter, there's a kinematic no-go theorem, because now your particle does not have enough energy to ionize an outer shell xenon atom. Right. So the idea here is actually to use the sun as a particle accelerator. And so if dark matter scatters on electrons, it may as well scatter on hot electrons inside the sun. And so the picture we have in mind is dark matter with a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution falls into the sun. It experiences scatterings with hot electrons, and so it upscatters in energy. So this is unlike GEV. WIMPs, they lose energy when they come into the sun. These particles will gain energy when they come into the sun. And a few of these will scatter in the direction of Earth. And with that upscattered energy, they have a potential to ionize xenon. So very simple. What we did here is actually a Monte Carlo simulation of this process, because it's difficult to get it analytically. It's easy if you have one scattering, and it's easy if you have many scatterings, but it's hard if you have a few scatterings to know what's really your spectrum. But parametrically, what you expect is a much suppressed flux of these particles. And so the maximum flux you can get is basically given by the fraction of the solid angle the sun subtends on the sky. And that's a factor of 10 to the minus 5. So it's a small flux, but it's large enough. So again, we crank our machinery of taking these electron recoils through the various experiments. And here, all the limits we could derive from this. And so again, now we are having extended our view on dark matter below 10 MeV.
What does stellar constraints mean there? What does stellar constraints mean there?
Yeah, so if it's below 100 keV, then you start producing dark matter inside stars, and this is just a schematic limit. energy loss, anomalous energy loss limits the existence of this problem.
For giants, for giants.
Right.
So, look, but then you've got this upscattering all the time, right? So, of this dark photons through the stars.
Yeah, there's no dark photon here. Sorry, this is.
And you get this upscattering that is above the escape velocity from.
So the escape velocity from the surface of the sun is actually 670 kilometers per second. So it's larger than escape velocity from the galaxy. So these particles come in with the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, but when they are at the surface of the sun, they are already dominated by the gravity basically of the sun. And then they upscatter and they come out. And we take into account the sort of the redshifting of the particle as they have to climb out of the gravitational well.
So
we do take this into account.
They still remain in.
No, they escape. I mean, they make it to Earth.
But what I mean is that you basically get this you add kinetic energy to the dark matter particles, right?
Yes.
But then you have to worry that they might escape the halo itself. Right.
Most of them will, because when they escape from the surface of the sun, they also escape the galaxy. That's what I'm just.
But then the question is, how many of them would remain after a certain time, right?
It's a very small effect. So we also looked at of the contribution coming from all stars and the Milky Way, basically the solid angle subtended by all stars on the Milky Way is a very small number. On the night sky, and so this is a small contribution. But yeah, sure. There is a intergalactic flux of these particles. Sorry?
So in this case, you're specifically looking for the signal of such particles accelerated by the sun.
Yeah.
You know, the solid angle.
This is it's rather model independent. The only model dependence really comes in from how you scatter on an electron. So here we use the contact interaction. So in the standard mass frame, the scattering is isotropic. You can also consider now the light mediator case. Then there's sort of a forward biasing in the scattering, and that's we'll follow up on this.
The limits from supernovae, are these cross sections large enough that you're trapped inside, or do you just not produce enough?
I do not know now.
Because those will go up to a few tens of MeV or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. That's right. But I wonder if you looked at that. But actually, they will be trapped inside. They will be trapped inside the supernova because 10 to minus 36 is, or 10 to minus 34. 10 to minus 36 is the cross section where the sun becomes opaque to these particles.
Okay.
And the sun is sort of a rarefied gas in comparison to a supernova.
Okay.
So these particles will be well trapped.
So then things which are trapped inside supernovae, often those cross sections are strong enough that beam dumps things start being interesting. But you're not constrained by the collider type.
We also looked at this. So now it depends whether it's on shell or off shell. Whether the mediator is produced on shell or off shell.
Yeah.
And we are safe.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at this. But it's,
okay. So there's a gap.
If you look very closely, it's not that far away.
Okay. So there's some gap that which you want to set in.
Yeah. So, but we looked at this. All right. Okay. So in my last part, I'd like to discuss now dark matter decay into dark radiation. And so the picture we have in mind is, of course, the amount of dark matter is very well measured through CMB observations. And so we leave this picture intact at the time of decoupling, that we have 26% cold dark matter. But that in the later cosmological history, a part of this dark matter can decay, and it will decay into massless or almost massless particles. So it will create a dark radiation component, and so it, there's dark radiation permeating the universe now, and we can ask what are the signatures of that cosmic component. And I have two parts here, and so this first part, the logic here is to consider dark radiation, which is in number much smaller than the number of CMB photons, but in energy they are much harder than a CMB photon. And so we can get this dark radiation from either from the decay or from the inhalation of dark matter. Here we consider the decay just for because it's the most efficient progenitor for relativistic flux, if you want. So you maximize the fluxes if you do it via decay. So if all of the dark matter decays now, then you get for sure the very biggest flux you can have in these particles. And there are, of course, limits on the possibility of dark matter decay, still coming from CMB, because there's a late time ISW effect, and also lensing puts you, allows you to decay a few percent of dark matter if the lifetime is smaller than the age of the universe. And if the lifetime is longer than the age of the universe, then the limit becomes also dependent on the lifetime, and it's about, so F is the fraction of dark matter that decays. And so if all of dark matter decays with a long lifetime, basically it needs to live 12 Hubble times.
And you're assuming it decays to essentially massless things?
They don't have to be massless. You can make them massive enough to avoid unaffected constraints, for example. So it can be 5 MeV, or it can be a few MeV. So the dark radiation state can be such that it doesn't contribute. If you're thermally populated in the early universe, it doesn't contribute to an effective. You confused?
Yes.
Why?
What are you assuming a dark matter decays to? Something that's essentially light, or a light thing?
So if dark matter has 100 MeV, and it decays to particles of 10 MeV each, and these 10 MeV particles can be thermalized in the early universe, but they will have a number density small enough so that they don't contribute to ineffective. Just because they are Boltzmann suppressed in them and their population. I mean, one can put more details to the statement, but roughly that's what happens.
You haven't been the normal EBN bound.
Yeah, sure.
So they're sure. Freezing out. That.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
have a thermal abundance that freezes out. Sure.
Yeah, if they have a thermal abundance and they weigh 10 MeV, then delta N effective is a small number. If it's 1 MeV or less, then delta N effective becomes a larger number. Well, we can discuss this many times. All right. So there are two sources of relativistic fluxes we can consider then, a galactic and an extragalactic one. So if it's just a two-body decay, then of course it's a monochromatic spectrum up to broadening from velocity dispersion, but that's a small effect. And so you get a line from the galaxy, and you get a redshifted continuous distribution from decays that happen at earlier redshifts. And if you look at the numbers, you find that the maximum flux that you can have, which is sort of broadly compatible with constraints on the amount of decaying dark matter, then it's about 10 to the 6 per centimeter squared in second for a 10 MeV particle. So that gives you the ballpark of numbers here. And so this is a very large flux if you compare it to atmospheric neutrino flux or diffuse supernova neutrino background at these energies, which is in the order of a few. So there's a possibly very large fluxes,
For this situation, is this constrained by the Dipolin and LaGuardia?
Yeah. Okay. Well, so what we did here was just we take their limits, and we, I mean, This one is just this is an illustrative plot, so there is no limit in there. We just assume that 10% of dark matter decays here with an arbitrary lifetime, and ask what are the fluxes. But in the end of the day, there will be, it should be 3%, and then you're fine with these constraints. So just 10% was just a easier number somehow, but the logic goes through. All right, so if you decay into dark radiation, then we have two options. The first option is that dark radiation actually standard model neutrinos. They have an obvious benefit in terms that there are no ineffective constraints, and that the interactions are very well known. And an example of a progenitor which gives you neutrinos would be a Majorone. And if you take that option, then there are, of course, constraints on how much new flux you can add into the universe without being in conflict with direct measurements. And so if you look at this energy line here, then neutrino fluxes are very well measured below, say, 16 MeV or so, because these are just solar neutrino fluxes. Above 16 MeV, the solar neutrinos die out, but below 30 MeV, the main channel to detect neutrinos is by inverse beta decay with Nui bar. So, for example, through super K. Super K has a lot of water, so it has a lot of free protons, and you get this process basically kinematically unsuppressed. It's much more difficult to detect neutrinos rather than antineutrinos, because there you need to react on a neutron, and the neutrons are buried inside the nuclei, and so you first have to lift out the neutron to react with it, and so there's an energy penalty given by the nuclear binding energy. And so you need actually higher energetic neutrinos in order to see this sort of reactions.
The first one, these look like the normal super K signals. The normal super K signal, that's what you're saying.
This one?
Yeah.
Well, they take all these channels into account, of course.
So this is for their normal signal analysis.
Sorry, what do you mean with normal?
Well, how is it differentiated from just normal neutrinos? Not resulting from late dark radiation.
Yeah. Okay. Let me move forward here and show you. This is what we did basically. So this is a super K search on diffuse supernova neutrino background, and this is the signal window if you want.
Okay.
And there are various backgrounds, and some of them can be measured in sidebands, basically, and then can be applied to the signal region. And other backgrounds are actually unknown, and they're just fitted, okay? And so now we can throw in dark radiation and do a joint fit of fixing the backgrounds that are measured in the sidebands, plus the variable backgrounds which are known in shape but not known in amplitude, and add to it the dark radiation signal, and then so this red line here, for example, would be the dark radiation signal, and then we get from the super K data we get the total admissible flux of dark radiation, and that's basically shown here. Now again, the same plot of progenitor mass versus lifetime of dark matter, and so what we compare is direct detection sensitivity. Now these neutrinos can also scatter coherently on nuclei inside detectors, or they make a signal in super K. And here it turns out that albeit there is direct detection sensitivity, it's excluded by super K basically. But you can turn this around, this picture, and you can say, say you sit somewhere on the boundary, so which would give you the maximum admissible flux you can have in this new dark radiation. And at this boundary, basically what you do is you lift the neutrino floor. So the punchline here is that neutrino fluxes in this energy regime are not very well known. So in a few tens of MeV, they're not very well known. And you can add more neutrinos, not antineutrinos because they do the inverse beta decay reaction, but you can add more neutrinos up to 2 orders of magnitude, and you will get the correction to this neutrino floor in this picture, up to 2 orders of magnitude. That's the statement here. And we're currently working out these plots. Again, if you decay into a new species, then you have many more possibilities. And then indeed, here is again a baryonic current interaction. Then you can, then direct detection experiments can be superior to neutrino experiments to seeing this sort of dark radiation. Okay. I have one last topic on 21 centimeter. Shall I quickly walk you through this as well? Okay, good. All right, so let's stay with this general picture of dark matter decaying into dark radiation at low redshifts. And now let's pick a different setup. Let's not consider hard quanta, but very soft quanta in comparison to the CMB. But the number of quanta can now be much in excess of the number of quanta in the CMB. So that, but still in a way that the product of this new radiation is much smaller than the total radiation content in the universe. And so what would be the prospects of detecting such a dark radiation background? Well, it might be very difficult if you consider light fields that, with higher dimensional operators, because their interactions are sort of suppressed at low energies. And so, for example, neutrinos that have Fermi-type interactions with atomic constituents or axion-like particles with dimension 5 interactions, this will be very hard to see. But again, here's an these are loose statements, but there is an exception in terms of dark photons because their interactions can manifest themselves at low energies and low densities. And indeed, it's possible to have lots of this new dark radiation when you compare it to the CMB. And here we are thinking about adding dark photons in the Rayleigh genes tail of the CMB. So they're very low energetic compared to the temperature of the CMB. So X is a small number. And so, for example, if you pick X 10 to the minus 3, then you can be far in excess of the total number of photons in the CMB. All right, so here's the picture we have in mind. This is the cartoon to it. So recombination happens, and CMB photons are released. And now we have a dark matter. Here A can be an axion, or an axion-like particle, which decays into two dark photons. And now these dark photons, eventually, they will go through resonant conversion, and we create real photons out of them. And so here you see the CMB, and then there's sort of a soft component where dark photons go into real photons, and so we get a correction to the Rayleigh genes. So this is the Rayleigh genes term of the CMB. And we get a correction to this tail. So this is the picture here that was pointed out before. You have to ask when does such a resonance happen? And it happens when the mass of the dark photon equals the plasma frequency. And so this plot here shows you the plasma frequency. So MA is the photon mass, or the plasma frequency, as a function of redshift. And this curve basically tracks the ionization history of the universe. So recombination happens, and then reionization happens. And right, and so within this regime here, it's possible if you pick, it's possible to have a resonant conversion of this dark photon bath you created into regular photons.
Sorry, I came in a little bit late on the slide, but so this is showing the plasma frequency in sort of the average spot in the universe.
So at some point the universe becomes clumpy and
right.
no longer looks homogeneous.
Yes. True.
What? How much an effect does that have on this picture?
That's a great question. I think that question becomes more and more relevant for later conversions. And that's something we haven't really done yet, but we are currently doing, looking into photon fluxes, for example, converted inside clusters of galaxies.
Yeah.
And there is definitely this contribution of fluctuations in the plasma mass, if you want. Yes, absolutely. I mean, here we are well in the linear regime.
I mean, below about, I don't know, guess edge of sort of 20-ish or so, it probably doesn't really happen.
Right, but we don't really care about these conversions.
Okay.
I mean, you can, and 21 centimeters also sensitive to later conversions, but for this first paper, we basically consider conversions at earlier times where these are not real issues. Right, and so the probability of conversion is shown here. At some point, if you convert too early, then you have free photons, they just get absorbed by free absorption. So it's basically inverse Bremsstrahlung that's shown here. So below a redshift of 1700, these photons survive that you have converted. And this is shown here. So this is in this dimensionless variable. So these are photon spectra. CMB, that's the Rayleigh Jeans tail of the CMB. This is a 21 centimeter frequency. This here is the spectrum of dark photons that you create by the decay of, say, an axion into two particles. So this is a monochromatic decay, but then it redshifts, it becomes continuous, and that's the continuous spectrum you see here. The conversion probability itself has a 1 over omega. And so it biases conversion of lower frequency mode. And so out of this spectrum, you get a converted spectrum that goes like that. And so for some values of parameters, you can make as many converted new photons as there have been in the CMB.
Why is the A prime before conversion not a delta function? Because you at least scale up 1 plus...
No, it's a delta function at the point of injection, and then it redshift.
But you scaled up the redshift on the y-axis of that?
Sorry? Yes, there's a redshift that's scaled out here. But there's a...
So you get injected with the delta function, and you've scaled up the redshift like that.
Yeah, you can. You worry about the variables here? Or you worry why it is continuous, not a delta function? Okay, so this is like the extragalactic diffuse photon flex, for example. If you're you decay all the time and you get a delta function at each. I mean.
I
don't know how to explain
it. But I thought that you scaled it out on the way.
Sorry?
I thought you scaled it out.
No, this is the spectrum at conversion. So there's a resonance redshift is chosen, and so these are all the photons that have been injected before redshift of 500, and that's the spectrum they had. There's still a redshift of conversion in here. I mean, I can make the same plot, dn over d omega, and pick a particular redshift. I preferred that presentation actually, but somehow collaborators decided to switch to this x variable. But I guarantee you, nothing fishy is going on. So.
What is 21 centimeters on electron
volts? It's a micro EV, 6 micro EV. So. Josh says it's the new unit. Right, so here it's 21 centimeter, it's 1.4 gigahertz, or it's 6 micro EV. And so the idea here is that an additional population of photons, it will start interacting with this two-level atomic system of neutral hydrogen, where you have either parallel or anti-parallel spins. And this transition here has a wavelength of 21 centimeter. And so if you want to compute the number of high energy versus low energy states, it will be given by a Boltzmann equation of this type, where you can excite into the triplet state either by collisions or by absorption, and you can de-excite either by spontaneous emission or induced emission. And this I nu, this intensity here, is basically tells you the number of photons in that particular frequency band. And so the relative population is given here by this exponential, where T star is now this frequency here, and TS is what's called the spin temperature. And so very quickly, the standard expectation is that photons, the photon path and hydrogen gas, they start decoupling from each other at about a redshift of 200 or so, and then the hydrogen gas just adiabatically cools and it gets colder than CMB photons, and this spin temperature, and at some point reionization happens, and then the gas is heated up just by the light from stars, by the UV light from stars. And the spin temperature here either tracks the gas or tracks the CMB. And so first it will track the gas just because of collisions. And at some point this becomes inefficient, and then it starts tracking the CMB until you produce the first stars, and then it recouples, and then the spin temperature goes down before everything gets heated.
Yes.
So this here is CMB temperature, radiation temperature. This here is gas temperature. This, the dashed line is gas temperature. And this here is the spin temperature. So this is sort of the standard expectation. Okay, so this this blue is the standard expectation, and this red is... so there was the edges result. So this here has been measured. So as long as the spin temperature is below the CMB temperature, you expect absorption. Once the spin temperature is higher than the CMB temperature, you would expect emission in 21 centimeter. But as long as it's lower, you expect absorption. And the strength of the absorption depends on the difference between the radiation temperature and the spin temperature. And this is measured by what's called this, a brightness temperature. And basically, that's what I just said. So it is given in terms of this ratio of radiation versus spin temperature here. And the result that this collaboration finds is a value of minus 0.5 Kelvin, which is much lower, it's a factor of 2 lower than what is expected from a standard cosmological evolution. And then now two apparent ways of explaining this. Either you make the radiation temperature higher, and radiation temperature really, it just means basically the number of photons in the 21 centimeter band. Or you can make the spin temperature lower, and this is what was shown in this previous plot here. Like if you cool down the gas, if you have an anomalously low gas temperature, then the spin temperature drops further down. And so the idea here was that you need a coolant for doing this, and the coolant could be dark matter. So if dark matter interacts with baryons, it can sort of drag down the temperature. It turns out that this is hard to achieve. With various constraints.
Can you explain the cooling? I didn't quite understand.
The cooling?
In the yellow part there, where the spin temperature, it looks like it gets almost to the radiation temperature.
Yes.
And then it drops down quickly to the gas temperature.
Yes. So
what's the physics?
I think it's called Lyman alpha pumping, but. So you inject a lot of photons that interact stars inject a lot of photons that interact with this two-level system, and that apparently recouples the spin temperature to the baryon temperature. I think basically everything is given in this Boltzmann equation here. And I guess it's just Lyman alpha photons really interacting with hydrogen. But the very detail of the process, I don't know why this. I understand this part very well. I mean, it's clear. So if you have a collision term that dominates, then collision decouples. Then you're dominated by these other two terms. Oops. You're dominated by the Bs. And then the first stars, how they exactly do this, I think these are Lyman alpha photons, but the precise details of the process, I don't know. Didn't have too much time to dig into all the details of this. The reason is, this is data.
And so this is the cooling?
This is a surface, this is basically measuring this difference between radiation and spin temperature.
This thing going down and then back up, that's the...
That's reionization.
That's the dip in the previous plot?
Yeah, basically it is, yes. That's right. So here it tracks radiation, and this difference is zero, and then this happens.
You would expect it to be lower to the left of where those lines are all solid.
Sorry?
From your previous plot, the spin number curve was below the, or maybe the next, yeah, to the left of that brief time.
You mean this shift here?
The point when spin temperature is coupled to radiation, that point, yeah, to the smaller z.
Oh, there's no
larger, the larger z.
To the left?
Yeah, to the left. The larger z, the difference is also large. So you should expect that signal to be low on the left side of the plot, or at zero. So then the next, whatever the data was, you'd expect it to go down.
But that's not much redshift, though, right? That's only a tiny range.
You mean right here, it should go down, you know what?
Yeah.
This is, they showed a pretty narrow band, actually.
Yeah, they don't have large side bands
in it. It looked like a very challenging signal to pick out. So there is a synchrotron radiation, which is a few thousands of Kelvin, and this is now 0.5 Kelvin, so this is a very small signal that needs to be dug out. Anyway, so the so what you can do is this binary choice of either cooling the baryons or adding more photons. And so that was the point of the paper, to add photons through the resonant conversion. And this plot here on the left basically shows you that in this particular model, you pick a certain progenitor mass, so here 10⁻³ eV. They inject photons, and then you pick a conversion redshift. The conversion redshift is given to you by the dark photon mass, so whenever you hit the plasma frequency. And then here we explore how many more photons you can add in the Rayleigh gene tail, and it turns out you can add a lot, so a factor of 10 more, before the value of epsilon, so of the kinetic mixing, becomes too large when you start to run into stellar energy loss constraints, or into the old Kogel-Firas conversion constraint, where you lose photons into dark photons. And on this right-hand side of the plot, basically, the number of new, so this one line here has been chosen, so the number of new photons is equal to the number of Rayleigh genes photon in the CMB. So that's when you solve this edges result, and this whole parameter space is actually allowed here. And so it's from that perspective, it's it can easily explain the edges result. On a more general note, I would say that even if edges goes away, 21 centimeter astronomy can still tell us about these really soft modifications of the CMB.
Remind me, it's been a long time since I've thought about the Pixie prism proposal. What's the timeline or feasibility for that?
I don't think there's a timeline.
Okay, still.
that's last I heard. All right, half past. Let me just flash you the conclusions here, and thanks for your attention.
Mix with SU2 and lead to dark Z bosons?
There is a mixing with the C as well. It's just much smaller. So you mix it with U1 hypercharge, and then you also get a mixing with the C boson. It's just, if you look for higher, for larger dark photon masses, then there will be constraints from the from LHC, and this is through the mixing with the C boson as well.
So Z prime.
The dark photon becomes a C prime at some point if it's heavy enough. If we are back to terminology.
For your last scenario, the 21 centimeter one. Do you need a requirement on the abundance of the dark photon in the universe?
The dark photon is just we live in this parameter space where it would even evaporate away, but we don't need a we don't have an initial abundance of these dark photons. They are entirely they weakly coupled and they're entirely sourced by there's no other constraint. They're just sourced by the dark matter decay. Now, of course, there's a conspiracy this order one number in converted photons relative to CMB photons. So that's the ugly side of this proposal. Yeah, it could be a value much larger, much smaller than this. Sorry.
If you found it, you found it.
Not
your fault.
But the essential thing is that you need to populate those photons, so you provide a mechanism through this oscillation. If there's any other way, let's say potential, you also can do the job.
The papers are written on dark matter annihilation and these things, but it's much more difficult if you bleed into the higher frequency bands where it's measured by FIRAS, for example.
Yeah.
So it's also possible here to get a FIRAS constraint. So if the mass of the progenitor is large enough that you convert also higher energy photons, you can also run into this constraint. But you don't need to, because you can make the dark the progenitor mass as small as 10 to the minus. You can make it in the micro EV range if it converts just before redshift of 20, and you get away with it. So. There's plenty of room to play with, actually.
You mentioned in the paper that, the question is, can you account for the arcade excess and also get around?
I think it's unlikely because, there was one paper which says that if you want to explain both jointly, arcade excess and edges, you need basically 1% of photons in the lower frequency band versus in the 17 megahertz versus the arcade. And here this is it's 1/omega biased, so you get more photons in the low energy band than in the high energy band. So it will make a small contribution to arcade.
Where is arcade on this? Is it like 10 to the minus 2?
Arcade is It's 1 gigahertz at redshift of 0. So there's a factor of 20 in between.
there's no further questions, let's thank those.